When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to All Stats Aren't We, a podcast in which Leeds fans cast their combined eye over goings-on at Elland Road, giving scrutiny to the underlying statistics and tactical footings at work at Leeds United. I'm John McKenzie, the Premier League return of the podcast, many years in the making and bringing only misery and anxiousness. And I'm joined by the Calvin Phillips England debut of the podcast, Tom Woodhead, much anticipated, but ultimately disappointing, just as we knew it would be. And finally, the 7-0 hammering of the under-18s of the podcast. Leaky back line, a mismatch, and not pleasant for anyone. It's Darren Driver. Darren, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right, thanks. I did wonder which of the disappointing events of last night I was going to get lumbered with. So I'm a bit saddened it was a 7-0 thrashing. But there we go. That's life, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we didn't have you on the preview episode, so and we didn't actually do any bad things on that. So we've been saving them up. So you really got the unleashing of negative events in recent days of Leeds United. So I'm sorry about that.
It's all right. It was noted when I listened to it that happened. So I was ready.
Tom Woodhead, how are you doing?
I'm flustered. I've just had a man in my house fixing my TV for about an hour when it could have taken about 5 minutes. But yeah, I'm fine.
you sound like you're over it already.
I'm never going to get over this, I don't think.
So without further ado, and because of the man with the TV who has thrown our time schedule out, we will jump into the news from this week. We've already mentioned the 7-0 thrashing. The Leeds under-21s technically lost to Accrington Stanley in the EFL Trophy last night. But as we know, the under-21s were populated by, in fact, many under-18s players.
Many under-16s, by the looks of it.
Yeah, some of them were under-16. Well, Charlie Allen, the captain, is 16 years old. And unsurprisingly, the result was not pretty in that respect. Just a few things. The explanation that was given via Adam Pope yesterday was that because of various bubbling issues and because Marcelo Bielsa had decided to keep his under-23 squad available for a murder ball session today, in terms of the first team's preparations for Premier League return, the under-18s were brought in instead. So that was the explanation given. A lot of people were very upset on the timeline yesterday. So Darren, we'll start with you. What's your thinking on this whole debacle, we'll call it?
I don't really care, to be honest, about cup football. I completely understand Bielsa's reasons for wanting to keep his 23s available. My only wish is that he would have sent under-18s in the places of Cock and Rodrigo and Phillips instead of sending the actual players, and then we could have spent the week preparing for Liverpool instead of other things happening.
I think there's a sense, for me anyway, which people are blaming the club here for an issue which is probably out of their hands to a large extent.
Absolutely.
Because they will have planned to join this competition months ago, and the way that things have happened with the Premier League and with international football and with Leeds' transfer strategy has meant that they've got to this situation where they're expected to play a game without the requisite players available. Tom Woodhead, how do you feel about this in terms of the under-18 players' developments? Because it seems to me that the the people who really lost out here was those youngsters who not only had to sort of go through the ignominy of losing a game, but sort of went through the ignominy of losing a game as sort of sacrificial lambs, as it were, for the under-21s. Do you think there could be any longer-term issues that come out from this sort of approach to the EFL Trophy?
Well, I definitely think we can see a half-hour apology in Bielsa's press conference tomorrow. He's definitely get some serious airtime. It might serve them well to realise just how big the step up is. I imagine when you're a decent standard at that age, it's hard to envisage how big that step up to senior football is going to be, and this will be a bit of a wake-up call to those players, I guess. Obviously, it's not ideal. You never want to get hammered 7-0. It's not the same as getting hammered 3-0, where you could say this, you know, they've battled bravely. But at the end of the day, the club exists for the first team, essentially. So we had to do what was right for the first team in this situation. And Villa have done exactly the same thing, and possibly more clubs. So, you know, I don't think it's something that's unique to Leeds United.
Yeah, I guess my only concern here is that when you scattergun approach this with under-18s players and hammer all of them at once, I just wonder whether or not that sort of kicking of confidence will be useful for the under-18s as a club going forwards this season. I'm not sure it's going to be that great for them just going forward into their league this season to go in off the back of that sort of hammering.
Oh, so. Yeah, I'm totally clutching at straws when I brought out those mild positives. I mean, it's obviously it's going to be awful for them in most ways, I imagine, and it'll knock their confidence. But apparently, from the reports I read, they kept trying to play the entire time. And I saw some quotes from the Accrington Stanley manager, who was basically saying, you know, they kept at it and they did themselves proud. So, you know, they can take some heart from that, I guess.
Yeah, I did watch the game, actually, mainly out of interest. And it was quite hard to judge players, to be honest, in terms of what was going on in the field, because it was just such a mismatch. I mean, some of the Aki Stanley players were... like some of their players were well over 6 foot. They've got a player who's 6'5", and you're talking under 16s here who are still sort of doing their growing. And so it just seems very, very harsh to really look at it in terms of trying to determine how good the players are for the Leeds under 18s.
I don't think anybody learned anything from the match. Is my view, and I don't necessarily think it will knock the players in an undue way. I mean, I think they would have gone into the game expecting to take a bit of a hammer in any case, I would imagine. So,
apart from anything, I fundamentally disagree with us being in this competition to start with. But
yeah, me too.
That's a separate argument, really. But we you know, it's good for us and it's good for our youth team. But I don't think it's the right thing to do to enter a team into this competition, personally.
I think in the long run, that was probably seen as a good developmental curve for the under-23s. But as I've said, you know, when things have come round the way that they've come round, it suddenly starts looking like a complete nightmare. But we'll see how this unfolds. And hopefully in the next two games in the group stages, the under-23s will be able to get some practice in and we'll be able to put a bit of a better performance on for us. Another performance that many Leeds United eyes were on yesterday was the Calvin Phillips England performance, a performance I haven't caught yet, but I will be going back over actually and re-watching that, because I think I'm going to do an analysis video on Calvin Phillips's England debut on our Patreon. So if you're Patreon subscribers, keep an eye out for that. Darren, I know that you did watch it. What are your thoughts coming away from watching that game?
Yeah, there's very little that can make me watch an England game that isn't connected to the World Cup. So that just shows how much I love Calvin Phillips. I thought the game was incredibly poor. I thought the England setup, particularly in the first half, was a really kind of stodging defensive 3-4-3, which was not really designed to make any player shine, and I don't think any player really shone. Having said that, I think that once Calvin settled down after the first 20-25 minutes, when he did look a bit edgy and a bit nervous and got caught on the ball a couple of times, I thought he grew into the game and played with some real credits. There was some really lovely long passing. He really got stuck in. You know, in terms of winning the ball, I think he won a good number of tackles. And I think all in all, he comes away with his head held high.
Tom, did you manage to catch the England game yesterday?
I did. I have to echo what Darren says. It was a bit of a mess, the system, certainly with the players that we played in it. Maybe if we had a centre forward who really liked to drop deep a lot, it might have worked a little bit better. But in general, it having Phillips and Rice in that midfield together with no one ahead of them, it just didn't work at all, and it didn't make any of the players look good. Phillips played okay. He played some, especially in the second half. His passing was good. He played some decent long balls. I think we did see a couple of elements of him not being great when he's under pressure, which I think our system, it kind of protects him from that a little bit, because he doesn't tend to get put under that kind of pressure, and that sort of shows how deeply Bielsa's thought about the things that he's good at and the things that he isn't, and why he's chosen to mould him into that player, I think, because the way that he gets away from pressure tends to be to use his strength, I think, and that's going to be harder and harder the stronger players and the better technical players he's up against. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops when he comes up against some of the real bruisers in the Premier League.
I think it was really interesting because he was up against Christian Eriksen for a lot of the game last night, and Christian Eriksen was really good at cutting the passing lanes off both to and from Calvin, and I thought that was something which it took him quite a long time to get to grips with.
How do we feel this is going to affect his long-term England trajectory? Is this just an outlier debut that is going to make people think negatively about him, or do you think that he'll get chances again further down the line?
I think it would be harsh to stop giving him chances on the basis of just this, I think. I think he did well enough to deserve a second chance, but I think it also showed that if you're going to play this formation, you need someone who's got a bit more going forward in one of those two midfield spots. So I guess it depends partially on whether Southgate's going to stick with this system or not.
Yeah, my sense is that he won't. But in terms of Calvin's England future, I thought he was significantly better than Declan Rice last night. I don't think it will have done him any harm in that sense.
Right, quick update in terms of the transfer market, in which not very much is happening. Rodrigo de Paul, reports came out yesterday suggesting that our sources were correct in saying that Rodrigo de Paul was being hawked around other clubs and is waiting for a better offer than Leeds. How do we feel about this? A lot of Leeds Twitter seems to think that if a player wants to wait for an offer for Juventus, then he's not worthy of the Leeds shirt. Tom, how do you feel about that?
I think people need to step into the player's shoes a little bit more and think how he would feel. Of course, he's going to want to play for a team that wins the league every year and that is in the Champions League all the time. There are plenty of players around who've given their absolute all when they've been at Leeds and have then left and then sometimes even come back. Someone like David Batty springs to mind. Always gave his all when he was at Leeds, left Leeds to play at a higher level at that point, essentially won the league with Blackburn. Then when he came back, he worked hard for Leeds again. I think players, good players who do well, they put that stuff to the one side once they've signed for a club and they do their best in the games that they play.
Darren, what's your thinking on the Rodrigo de Paul, the saga? Do you feel as though it's likely that he's going to end up at the club, or have you resigned yourself to the fact that it's looking less and less likely as the days go by?
Yeah, I think I more or less have resigned myself to the fact that it's looking less and less likely, but I still don't think it's impossible. I think it's going to take something pretty special or a real kind of slowness in the market to bring him to Leeds, but I still haven't completely ruled it out.
And then finally, in terms of the transfer market, there was a Gvardiol update yesterday. Joško Gvardiol, the Dynamo Zagreb centre-back, is still being touted as a potential Leeds target. I can't remember who put the report out yesterday, but I think it was 22 million euros plus.
Yeah,
quite a
20%,
big chunk,
I think.
Yeah, big chunk, 15 or 20% of sell-on clause. Yeah, and that's still rumbling on. Darren, centre backs, we still need one. How do you feel? How do you feel about the potential of going into the season with only two senior centre backs?
Absolutely terrified. I'm not. Not a fan of that at all. I think three is one too few, at least one too few. So I think we absolutely need to get that position resolved as soon as we possibly can. Gvardiol looks really good, and I'd be very, really keen to have him through the door. And if it is him, great. But we just need we it's one of those situations where we almost just need a body, although I know that's not how Bielsa thinks in any way, shape or form. But
I was listening to a Spurs podcast the other day where they were talking about whether or not they could scrape through the season with four centre-backs. And I was like, you have no idea. Just a breaking news story, actually, now. Gianluca Di Marzio has just announced that Crescencio Somerville, the Feyenoord youth player, is going to Leeds on a permanent deal, which is, I think, an interesting one. No doubt he'll be in the under-23s, but again, he'll be one of those players in and around the fringes of the senior squad. Looks like a very tricky wide winger. Seems to fit with a lot of the sort of transfer strategy that we've been talking about this summer. Right, I think we should move on because we could talk about transfers all day long and it won't change anything. Obviously, this is the first of our preview podcasts for the new season, which is very exciting, I suppose. We kick off our season on Saturday afternoon against Liverpool at Anfield. No one has beaten Liverpool at Anfield in 3 years, so it will be a baptism of fire, I believe you call it. And in order to give us a sense of what to expect from Liverpool, I spoke to John O'Sullivan, a freelance journalist who's often found on the Anfield Index. So John, how are you doing?
I'm great, thanks. I'm glad that you asked me to be on. I'm quite excited about this.
Oh yeah? Why are you so excited?
Well, I get to discuss Marcelo Bielsa and Jurgen Klopp in the one conversation, so it's always a good moment for me when that happens.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a fun conversation. So let's just jump in on the Liverpool stuff. How are you feeling about the impending season as a Liverpool fan?
As things stand, I'd be quite confident that we'll be in there or thereabouts in regards to winning the title again. I think the signing of Kostas Simica, it's kind of gone under the radar a bit because everybody's fixated with Thiago, but Simica comes in with European experience, has a lot of qualities, profiles kind of similarly to Andre Robertson, and as much as I love him, and I'm sure Leeds fans would love him, James Milner filled in at left back, and he done an admirable job, don't get me wrong, but it just wasn't the same. So having someone who's left-footed, who's quick, and who can really add to the attack like Simica can is massive, especially for Liverpool because of the way their fullbacks are really their creative hubs.
In terms of the wider summer activity, are you happy with that? Do you feel as though there's areas you need to strengthen? Because it's a bit of a funny season, really, for Liverpool, having done so well in recent years and really not being able to bring in the players that they would like to because of costs.
Yeah, 100%. I think certainly they would need another forward, probably someone who can be an understudy for Sadio Mane. There's tentative links, I would say, to Ismail Assar, but doesn't seem to be anything substantive in that yet. Also, a backup centre-half. Lots of Leeds fans will know Ben White. Obviously, he was linked for a long time, but that looks like it's hit the skids now and that he's signed a new deal with Brighton, so I don't expect that to happen. And then there's obviously Thiago, who, if you would ask me before the links had started, did I think that we needed to address the midfield? I would have said no, not necessarily, given that I hope Keita plays a bigger role next season. But now that they've dangled the carrot of Thiago in front of me, I can't really get my mind off it. And I want that to happen at all costs. So I think they have a fair bit to do, but a lot of it, I think, will be predicated on selling players, which is obviously a lot more difficult now than it would have been. So it might go late to the window, but hopefully they get those three positions sorted.
And I guess for Liverpool fans, it's sort of an interesting position to be in when you've won the Premier League and the Champions League in recent memory. How do you go beyond that? How do you keep your team competitive and keep things ticking over? So how are you feeling about the summer in the season in that respect?
Yeah, that kind of ties into the needing more additions. I think you just need that like inner competition within the squad to keep people on their toes. I mean, a lot of people in that team are kind of guaranteed their spot, more or less. There's no real pressure on them for their places. And I mean, I don't expect anyone to come in, for example, and, you know, put Virgil van Dijk under major pressure. But there's definitely areas where a couple of introductions could keep players on their toes and, you know, get their best form out with them, or even just give them the opportunity to rest more and bring their A game more often when they're not being absolutely flogged in an intense style of football across several competitions in what is going to be an absolutely concertinaed season. I don't think a lot of people quite realise how compressed it's going to be and how many games there will be, you know, obviously depending on how teams will get on in various competitions. But I think even just that squad depth for rest is going to be huge. So I think that's going to be a massive factor.
So you've mentioned that you're a fan of Marcelo Bielsa, so I'm going to jump straight into the tactics chat. If you were asked to give an overview of Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool, what would you say? How would you describe Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool in a tactical sense?
I think they're very zealous in their adherence to a 4-3-3. But within that, there's a lot of rotation and a lot of interchange. So, for example, the front three are ostensibly a front three, but it more resembles the setup of a 4-4-2 diamond, because while Salah and Mane start in the left and right flank respectively, they cut in and they're more or less the central strikers. Then you have Roberto Firmino, who is nominally the nine. His role more resembles probably an orthodox number 10 in that he drops deep and likes to link the play. And then you see the number eights, they often play quite wide. I mean, good examples of that would be Sadio Mane's goal against Manchester City last season, where Jordan Henderson is on the byline, very, very tight to the line and crosses for him to head in. And then another example would be Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain crossing for Jorginho Wijnaldum to head in against Atletico Madrid. So whilst it is a 4-3-3, it's very amorphous. It moves a lot. You see Fabinho, Leeds fans will be familiar with this with Calvin Phillips. He drops deep between the two centre halves to be a three, you know, in the build-up phase. You see Trent Alexander-Arnold, who, you know, he's just a super player. He can go wide. He can play infield in the half spaces or even move very centrally. He used to be a central midfielder, but in his academy days. And when I was watching the Champions League final a couple of weeks ago, Joshua Kimmich's assist for Kingsley Coman was like the PG-13 version of Trent Alexander-Arnold's assist for Firmino against Chelsea a couple of weeks ago, where he just gets that ball in kind of central area and has managed to bend it around people and perfectly onto the head of the forward to score. So I think whilst it is not almost always a 4-3-3 for the last three seasons, there's a lot of interchange and movements within that structure. And I think that's really testament to Pep and Linder's growing influence on the team. I think he's definitely adds a new element to things.
And what would you say the strengths and weaknesses of this system are?
The weaknesses can sometimes be not so much of the system, but the players that he puts within them. So a lot of the time, a lot of the creative responsibility is delegated to the fullbacks. And, you know, they've averaged nearly 100 points over the last two seasons. So obviously it works well a lot of the time. But there are occasions when, especially when teams play a 4-4-2 deep block and double up on the fullbacks, that then the creative buck is passed to the midfielders and they just haven't been able to come up with the goods. Everton under Carlo Ancelotti are a good example, and actually when Ancelotti was at Napoli, are a good example of that plan working and nullifying Liverpool's attack quite a lot. So that's an area, and I suspect that's why they want Thiago, where they can definitely improve, is adding more creativity to the central band of the pitch and not always relying on the fullbacks to do everything, because, you know, they're also the fullbacks. They have defensive responsibilities as well, so there's a lot on their plate. So I suspect that really varying the point of attack is something that they'll look to do in the coming season, so that would be a weakness. And then the strength is, I mean, they're a team, they can play on the counter, they can play possession football, they can play very quick attacking football, they're good from set pieces. In a lot of ways, in the last two seasons, they've kind of reminded me of an Alex Ferguson team at United, in that, you know, they can kind of just find any way to win. You know, they have their basis, which is an intense pressing game, but, you know, within that, they can do and play a lot of different ways in order to get the win.
So a lot was made of Liverpool's overperformance of expected goals metrics last season, as well as Manchester City's underperformance of the same metrics. And obviously Leeds fans know a thing or two about underperforming XG, which may say something about the similarities between the way that Man City and Leeds play football. How do you come down on the Liverpool overperformance of XG? Is it just variance, or do you think that there's underlying structural causes that the models can't really account for yet?
I think there might be a little bit of an underlying structural element that the models can't really, you know, adhere to yet. Because if you look at Liverpool's post-shot XE, it's quite impressive. So their shot selection is excellent. They try to hit the corners quite a lot, and I think that's something they work on quite often. And then I think when you look at City, obviously, like in terms of creativity, they create a lot more opportunities than Liverpool do, and they score more goals. But they miss quite a lot as well. I mean, Raheem Sterling is quite prolific, but he's also, to my mind, not a great finisher, and it's something that's kind of been with him since his Liverpool days. And I would say the same about Gabriel Jesus. I don't think he's in the same league in terms of being a dead-eye finisher in front of goal than, say, Sergio Aguero. So I think a lot of that is Man City being a little bit profligate, but certainly I think it's something that Liverpool work on, and they try to hit the corners quite a lot, I think, with that.
And would you expect them to overperform XG again this season?
Yeah, they've done it now for probably 2.5 to 3 seasons in a row, so I don't see why they couldn't keep that going. I think certain teams in certain ways are always kind of belying their numbers. I think Burnley in the defensive perspective are quite like that as well. So unless something goes totally haywire, I would imagine they'd be there or thereabouts in a similar way again next season.
You've already alluded to this fact, but one of the things that's been most interesting about Jurgen Klopp's tenure has been his willingness and successfulness at evolving his team to suit the Premier League. Do you think we're going to see any tactical shifts from the German this season?
It was interesting because in the second half of the Community Shield final, they played 4-2-2-2, or in other words, the box midfield. It's something that he's kind of previously toyed with once or twice. I remember the final game of the 2017-18 season, they played against Brighton and they won 4-0 and they looked very good. A game that was famous for Dominic Solanke actually scoring a goal in. So I think it's something, yeah, they could definitely experiment with next season. If you look at a lot of the players they've signed, they've come through the finishing schools of Red Bull, Leipzig or Salzburg, where they nearly always adhere to that style of play. So whether it's Mane, Keita or Minamino, they're all accustomed to playing there. Then you have the likes of Fabinho, who played in the two-man midfield at Monaco. You have Thiago, hypothetically, if he comes in, he's well-versed to playing in a two-man midfield. And then it would just be another way of fitting all the attackers into the same team at once. I often think about Manchester City under Manuel Pellegrini in 2013 and 14, and they played that shape, and it was just a mechanism for them to fit David Silva, Samir Nasri, Aguero, Torre and Negredo into the same team in a balanced kind of a way. I know there was a lot on Fernandinho's plate that season defensively, but you know, they managed to make it work. Ralf Hasenhüttl is quite successful with it at Southampton, I think. So it's something to look out for. I think the ideal time to change is when you're on top, and don't let stasis kind of creep in. So, I mean, it's the ideal time to do it now whilst everybody is still trying to figure out how to stop your usual plan. So I think that's something we could keep an eye on.
And one final question on the generalities of this season. How do you see the title challenge going this season? It's obviously going to be a battle between you and Manchester City. How do you see it unfolding?
Yeah, I think it'll be Liverpool and City once again. A lot of people are talking about how well Chelsea are spending money and how well, you know, well, not and maybe United to a lesser degree. But I think Chelsea's issues are still between the sticks, at the back and in the dugout. I think in all of those areas, they're weaker than Liverpool and the Manchester City. So I don't envision them challenging. They could well finish third, but like third, a distant third, quite like Manchester United this season. So ahead of the campaign, I mean, the same kind of issues are existing for Manchester City. They'd be looking to sign Kalidou Koulibaly, but to me that's strange because he plays off the left side of the defence, so does Aymeric Laporte, and so does the new signing from Bournemouth, his name escapes me, the Dutch kid.
Aki.
Yeah, Nathan Aki, sorry. Yeah, I know everything about him except his name. Yeah. So unless they're planning to go three at the back, I don't know how they would fit potentially Koulibaly and Laporte into the same team. I think certainly since they put Rodri into the team instead of Fernandinho, they look a lot more susceptible in the break. I think Fernandinho is far more streetwise than Rodri, and I think that shows. He used to get away with so many tactical fouls without getting booked. And he an excellent purveyor of the dark arts who everybody would love there on their team. So I think that's an area that they're weaker than they were previously. So unless they do maybe a little bit more reinforcements in their defense, and I don't think Messi is going to happen now. I think that's probably come out just before we started to record, it seems like. So depending on how they spend, I think Liverpool would still probably be favorites, but like you said, like Manchester City in terms of creativity are creating enough chances to win nearly every single game, so it definitely won't be as big a gap as last season, and they'll be there thereabouts for sure.
So you've already said that you're a big fan of Marcelo Bielsa. Why are you a big fan of Marcelo Bielsa?
Oh, I absolutely love him, and again, Leeds fans can relate to this. I first came across him in 2012 when his Athletic Club team absolutely rinsed United at Old Trafford. Now, in fairness, like admittedly, it doesn't take a lot for a Liverpool fan to be excited about Manchester United being defeated. But I mean, the football they played that night was absolutely amazing. It was out of this world. And I think they only won 3-2 at Old Trafford in the end. But if it had finished 6-2, no one could have complained. It was just beautiful to watch. It was just so amorphous. It was full of interchange and movement. And I remember thinking, the only player who I'm definitely sure has a fixed position in this team is Fernando Llorente and the goalkeeper. Because it was like everybody else was moving around and popping up, and the formation would change and the alignments would change. The likes of Oscar De Marcos was playing in about 7 positions. Iker Muniain was buzzing around the place. A young Ander Herrera was very impressive. So I was like, this is absolutely brilliant. And it was at a time where Liverpool were playing absolute dirge football every week. So I was like, football can be like this? Is this what it can be like? So I kind of followed his career then through Marseille, the couple of days he was at Lazio, and then obviously on to Leeds. And my cousin is a very big Leeds fan, so I'd always talk to him about Leeds to see how they're getting on as well. And he's been telling me about how good the football is, and about, you know, how really Bielsa has embedded himself in the local community. I love to hear stories like that. And so yeah, I think it goes back to 2012, and I've been my whole life trying to replicate that tactics on Football Manager, probably mostly unsuccessfully ever since. It's just my idea of like the ideal style of football, I guess.
How are you feeling about the visit of Leeds to Anfield next weekend? Is it going to be reminiscent, do you think, of Norwich's trip to Anfield at the beginning of last season?
You see, it could well be. Liverpool won that game 4-1, but if you actually watched it back, Norwich created a lot of chances and were very brave. And I think the margin of the scoreline kind of flattered Liverpool a tiny bit. So it could well be. And I think certainly Leeds would probably be better equipped to do better than them. I think like they'll press, they'll come to attack. They won't sit back and be meek. And in an empty stadium, you know, It could be the best time to come up against Liverpool. And even if they aren't to win, I think it's an ideal way for Leeds to start, because it's one of the hardest games of the season out of the way already. And if they have a good performance, then they can take a lot of confidence from that. I think from a Liverpool perspective, it's an ideal game because it's going to be intense one way or another. I think Liverpool are best when they're battle-hardened and when they have a lot of tough games in quick succession. We saw that last Christmas when they came back from the Club World Cup and they absolutely destroyed Leicester, and they went on this crazy run of great form. So I think having a really intense tune-up like that in the first game of the season is going to be great for both teams.
How do you think Klopp's going to set up against Leeds? Do you think Liverpool will just come out playing their usual way, or do you think there'll be any reaction in his part?
I think because the way I anticipate Leeds swarming Liverpool and pressing, it might be an ideal game for Naby Keita, who's so good in tight spaces and such a good player in the transition. So I can see him playing, it'll probably be the regular 4-3-3 shape. We don't know if Jorginho Wijnaldum is going to still be at the club from then, so it could be in midfield of Fabinho, Keita and A.N. Other. I'd imagine Jordan Henderson wouldn't be fit by that stage, so it might be someone like Curtis Jones. So I'd expect Klopp to line up in kind of their usual kind of alignment and kind of play in a similar enough style to what they usually do. And, you know, it's going to be refreshing for a Liverpool fan, because most teams' default setting against Liverpool is to sit in and kind of try and ride their luck. So for someone to actually come and try to take them on in the game of football will be nice to see. I mean, Salzburg done it last season in the Champions League and were only, you know, narrowly defeated 4-3 at Anfield. So, I mean, lots of teams lose anyway by playing so defensively, so you might as well try and come and have a go, and you never know, it could pay off.
And what ways do you think Leeds can cause Liverpool problems in particular?
Well, like I said, the midfield, like without Jordan Henderson and without Jorginho Wijnaldum, can sometimes be a little bit susceptible to the counter-attack. Without that kind of communication of Henderson, or like the tactical intelligence of Wijnaldum, I mean, I think a lot of people outside the Liverpool fan bubble don't quite appreciate like the role Wijnaldum does for the club. He really, like, if you have fullbacks who got 50 assists over the last two seasons and the team had the strongest defence in the league the both two seasons, that you can reasonably infer that they're being very well covered from their midfield. And that's what Wijnaldum is really, really good at. Sometimes he can go in early in the entire game, especially away from home, barely touching the ball, but he's such a good glue player, and he holds the midfield structure together so well that in his absence, it might be somewhere where Leeds could maybe get a little bit of joy putting pressure on the Liverpool midfield.
And you've mentioned a few of the players that will be out in the lineup on Saturday. What do you think the full team lineup will look like?
Okay, so it'll be Alisson in goal. Trent Alexander-Arnold is an interesting one. He missed all of pre-season with a minor injury. He's in the England squad now, so if he plays for England, then maybe he'll be sufficiently ready to play for Liverpool. But ask me right now, I'd say Nico Williams right back. That's probably maybe another area where Leeds could get a bit of joy. He's a kid fullback. He was a winger up until about 18 months ago, so he's kind of learning that role in the fly. So I'd expect him right fullback, centre half pairing of Gomez and Van Dijk, Robertson left back, Fabinho as a six, probably Naby Keita and maybe Curtis Jones, depending on others' fitness in the midfield, and then the regular front three of Salah, Mane and Firmino.
I don't usually ask for predictions on this podcast because I don't really think there's a huge amount of point, but you can offer one if you want. What I will ask is, how do you see the game unfolding on Saturday evening?
I think it's going to be a really good game, probably going to be four or five goals in it, a lot of pressing, a lot of intensity, and come the end of the game, there's going to be, a lot of mutual admiration between the two coaches, and they'll compliment each other in the post-match interviews. I think that really Bielsa said recently that Klopp was and his Liverpool team are the reference point right now, and I'm sure that Klopp has borrowed a lot of things over Bielsa for the years. Bielsa is probably one of the most influential coaches. You should just hear the way Pochettino, his former player, and Pep Guardiola speak about him. So I think the chances of it being a highly engaging, high scoring game of football are quite high. Liverpool are undefeated at Anfield since April of 2017, so it'd be hard to envision them losing. But I suppose with no fans in there in the first game of the season and they're not quite fully set yet, it could be as good time as any to try and win there. But I think it'll be a very good, entertaining game.
Well, John O'Sullivan, thanks so much for coming on and chatting to us. What's the best way for our listeners to follow you and the stuff that you put out?
Yeah, it's Notorious JOS on Twitter, and usually write about Liverpool on a daily basis for Anfield Index, but there's some other sports stuff littered in there too.
Well, thanks so much, and enjoy the game on Saturday.
No worries, thank you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So that was John O'Sullivan, freelance journalist, who is often found on the Anfield Index. Darren, what did you make of that?
Well, quite apart from his analysis of Liverpool, I was very, very pleased with his analysis of Chelsea. Problems between the sticks at the back and in the dugout. Amen. the stuff he said about Liverpool really kind of underlines the same things I was thinking and makes the fears that I've got for Saturday's game, just kind of the same, really. So, yeah, we're going to need to find a way to nullify the threat of the fullbacks, which is going to be incredibly challenging, and that front three are pretty fearsome. So I'm a bit worried about how we might kind of go about managing that. Having said all that, I don't think Liverpool are likely to maintain the kind of point collecting form of the last two seasons. I think that inevitably at some point their form is going to drop off. Whether that will have any impact at all on Saturday, I very much doubt, to be honest. But yeah, it's a really interesting set of challenges we've got to meet Saturday afternoon.
I think it's easy to not think too deeply about a tactical approach against Liverpool away, because it almost feels cheeky, perhaps, thinking, well, what can we do to get the most out of this game? But Tom, what approach do you think Bielsa should take going into this game, and what sort of aspects of the tactical side of things do you think will be going around his head?
Well, listening to the preview, he obviously watches football very deeply, and he seemed to... The area of weakness that he mentioned was basically in behind the fullbacks when they're attacking. Yeah. So, and that is the area that we try and counter anyway when we do have our rare opportunity to play counter-attacking football. So I guess that'll be it, won't it? Like, it's hard... The thing that I think we've always said is it's going to be really interesting seeing what happens when we don't have the ball all the time. We've seen it a few times, but certainly not against a team of Liverpool's standard, who, you know, could conceivably have 60% of the ball or something. We've seen times where it's been about 50-50, but we haven't had another team dominating the ball over us. So it'll be interesting to see if the players can cope with that as well, and if the players can, when we do get the ball, not panic and hoof it long like we saw against Barnsley last season at times.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I guess attack the flanks would be the answer to your initial question. Counter on the flanks.
I guess my thinking is probably not so much around how we hurt Liverpool, but how we stop Liverpool from hurting us. I think that's our bigger challenge on Saturday. And, you know, there are a number of ways you can slice it. So I was just thinking before we came on about who's going to pick up Firmino. Is that going to be Cooper? Or will Bielsa treat Mane and Salah as a front two and treat Firmino as a 10 and put Phillips on him, which I think is probably the most logical way of doing it.
That's how I would think about it as well.
But then that creates other problems, doesn't it? And as John quite rightly pointed out just before we press record, we don't actually have any centre-backs at the moment, which kind of creates a bit of a difficulty.
Yeah, so I guess what we were talking about there is that Liverpool line up in a 4-3-3, but actually at times it looks like a 4-4-2 with a diamond. So with Firmino dropping quite deep and the two wide players in that front three coming a bit narrower in counter-attacking situations. If you do that, the issue then becomes how do you sort out the sort of libero player, as Bielsa calls it, the plus one player who is there to sweep up. Because if you've got a back two and Firmino drops deep and your fullbacks are covering the wide players, then you've got two centre-backs not marking anyone. Do you allow your centre-back, i.e. Cooper, I suspect it would be in this situation, to follow or track Firmino into the midfield area? Or do you just play a back three and have the middle of the back three patrolling behind the other two who are tight on the wide players, and then have Phillips on Firmino? I like aspects of both, and I'm quite interested to see what happens. I just think that given that we're struggling for centre-backs as it is, I just think it might just be a step too far in this game. And so what we might just see is what I suggested with Cooper just sort of tracking Firmino out of defence. And yeah, that's kind of worrying on a certain level. There's also questions for me, I think, structurally about how we've talked about causing problems in terms of their build up through the fullback. And John himself said there's been times this season when Liverpool have struggled when teams have doubled up on their fullbacks and forced them to be more creative in central areas. And I think what we're going to see is we're going to see long stretches of the game where Liverpool will have really high possession. They'll have a really high line. I watched a couple of games back, and when they played against Bournemouth, and their back two are like on the wrong side of the halfway line, almost past the centre circle.
Yeah, they were on the edge of it, weren't they?
Yeah, so they're gonna sit there and they are gonna wait for us to break down, I think, in certain situations. And the reason why they use their fullbacks in those situations is because their fullbacks are so good at crossing the ball in that it gives them a little bit of an edge. So if you can double up on those, if you can get some sort of tandem system where whoever's playing in the two midfield eight positions, so maybe Click and maybe I guess Hernandez, if you just sort of drop them onto the ball near fullback, so Hernandez probably dropping onto Alexander-Arnold and Click dropping onto Robertson, and then have whoever's the striker sort of covering Fabinho, then what you do is you force them to be creative through Fabinho rather than through their fullbacks, who are much more dangerous, I think. That's a really tough system and requires a lot of training and practice to execute. But
thank God we've had so long to
we've had at least 4 days by my reckoning. So that's enough time for Bielsa, right?
But that was why I was kind of was thinking that the 3-3-1-3 system might make more sense, because then you can drop Costa and Harrison in on top of the kind of wing backs, and have whether it's Dallas and Douglas or Dallas and Alyoska or whoever ends up playing there, and kind of quite easily get that double cover. But what it will do is it will reduce our threat massively on the break, won't it? So what you'd be looking for ideally is Costa and Harrison being in positions where they can spring very quickly. But if they're having to sit so deep, that'll be a real concern.
I guess a lot of it depends on whether Bielsa feels like Koch is ready to play. If Koch's ready to play, then the back three becomes a lot more of a viable option, I think, because it wouldn't, you know, you can play Ayling on the right of the back three and Dallas at right back, and then play either Douglas or Alyoski at left wing back, and you know, that's a viable option. But I can't see him deciding to put Strike or someone in that back three, so I think a lot of it depends on, you know, how Koch's been doing in training and murder ball, etc.
Yeah,
I think one thing to add to this conversation as well has to be the fact that we're going to be playing in such a compact formation as well, if we're being forced back, that I actually don't think it matters too much, the difference between a 4-1-4-1 and a 3-3-1-3, because everything is going to be so compacted that it won't really make that much of a difference either way. And like you say, I think it then works better in terms of, the question is right, if we're playing really compacted, how do we decompress? We decompress in dangerous ways, in such a way as to be able to, one, beat the initial counter press that Liverpool will do? So as soon as they lose the ball, they're going to press hard, and what you've got to try and do is get vertical very quickly, and that's what you see in the goal against Arsenal in the goal for Arsenal in the Community Shield, is that you see the Liverpool lose the ball goes very quickly down the line to Saka switches play to Aubameyang, and then Aubameyang is one-on-one against Nico Williams and is able to get the shot away. There's lots of aspects there that are really important. The first one is that if you can get vertical quickly, then you're onto a winner. The other one is that because Liverpool play a midfield three who do a lot of lateral defensive work, because they're covering for those fullbacks going high and forward, they're also quite narrow. So if you can switch the ball quickly from one side of the other to the other, then you potentially cause problems as well. So I think in terms of decompression, that's going to be the strategy. Get forward quickly in wide areas and then try and switch it to the opposite side and get wingers and strikers into one-on-one scenarios with either fullbacks or centre-backs.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think the real question that we have to address now is about squad selection. So we've already mentioned Robin Koch. Darren, how likely do you think it is that we see Robin Koch at the weekend, and how do you think this will impact the way that we set up?
Yeah, I think we have to play him, really. I think we really don't have the depth in the squad to not play him, particularly if we're choosing to go with a four at the back. I think I've been pretty clear before that I really don't like seeing Ayling as either the centre of a three or as one of a two. So I think with that in mind, I think he has to give Koch the run out and just kind of see how it goes, really, which is not his normal method of preparation. I totally understand that, but I don't see what choice he's got.
So if we were not playing Koch and we went for a back three,
we're
talking Ayling on the right, Cooper on the left, and then, well, Cooper Ayling in the centre, and then someone on the right, presumably.
Yeah.
Who would that be? Casey Cresswell, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah.
You could play Strike on the left of a back three, I suppose.
You could play Strike on the left of a three, yeah. That's true.
Yeah, so that's a potential option that we could see. We could also see that with Koch, I suppose. But then I guess the issue would be, where would you play?
What about Drama? Could play Drama in the right, but then where would you play Ayling? You'd have to play him in the centre. Because I think that's kind of Drama's strongest position, isn't it? At the right of a three or at right back. So, But I think that's... Just given the training minutes he's had would be my only thought process there, but I think it's highly unlikely. Yeah.
The other option is that Phillips could play in the centre of a back three, as he has done before. I don't see it happening, but it is possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you'd have Stroke and...
ahead of that in midfield,
I'll be honest with you guys. I would not be happy with any of those setups, really, at this point.
I think
it's probably a case of trying to keep it as simple as possible. And for me, that would be just Cooper, Koch, and Phillips ahead. I guess you could always have Phillips just tracking through anyway, and following Firmino if we decide that Phillips is going to be marking Firmino. The only issue with that then is that how do you orientate the back back four plus Phillips against the front three of Liverpool, because you're going to have one of the fullbacks dropping in on one of the other wide players.
That's why the three really feels enticing when you really break down how Liverpool play with the striker dropping deep. The three feels almost like the obvious choice, doesn't it? Like personnel apart,
it does.
In which case, it might be good to just play Struyck as the centre of the back three, and then have Phillips in front of him, and have Phillips tracking Firmino, and then just have Struyck as the sort of free player at the back.
Yeah, or that could be Koch, depending on.
True.
If he deems him ready.
Yeah, and I guess it just depends on the question of how much. I mean, we all know what happened when Struyck played against Cardiff in defence. That's the only senior minutes I think he's had. Yeah,
Liverpool don't have a Lee Tomlin. They don't have anyone that's good.
Yeah. So these are all things that we need to take into account. I guess if we had Koch playing as the centre of a back three, and then you had Struyck and Cooper as outside centre backs, then you've got two left footed outside centre backs, which is probably a problem. So you've got to play one of Cooper or Struyck as the centre of a back three, in my opinion.
I think you'd go with Koch in the centre and Ayling and Cooper.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Play Ayling as the right sided centre back.
Yeah, and then you've
with
got Dallas
at right back.
Right back, and
yeah,
and Douglas at left back. Yeah, or Alioski.
But then how do you fit Kleek in the team? I'm just looking at this team. I've got it got written in front of me.
Well, you'd just take Hernandez out then, wouldn't you? And then keep Kleek.
Yeah, you'd have to take Hernandez out and just effectively play with the front three of Costa, Harrison and Bamford.
Might not be the worst thing to start the game with, and then bring Pablo on where he's needed later on.
So effectively, looking at a 3-4-3, and we know how well that worked for Calvin last night.
I think what I like about this setup is that you're thinking about the defensive structure, and you're not worrying too much about defensive cover in the middle, because I don't think you need to worry too much about defensive cover in the middle when it comes to Liverpool in that respect. I think the dangerous areas are out wide. So I'm fully on board with the 3-3-1-3 idea. I just think that... we just don't have the personnel to play it, which is why we've always been angling for an extra senior centre back. Because people say, "Well, you need three senior centre backs if you're ever going to play a back three system," which every team is going to have to at least countenance the idea of. And so, for me, I find it wild that people think we only need three centre backs. Because as soon as someone's injured, that's it. You're done. You've got no swivel.
That's true, but I mean, when you're talking about a back three, you have to count Ayling as a centre back as well. Because I think everyone agrees he's good on the right of a back three.
Yeah.
Yeah, but my problem there is that as soon as you start solving problems by moving players from other positions, then you create other problems for you. We don't, as soon as you have an injury and you move Ayling inside, then you're essentially saying we're going to have to play one of our weaker left backs because Dallas is going to end up playing right back. And I just kind of think you start then just exacerbating by solving problems by moving people around from other places.
Well, absolutely, but... I mean, we could another option. We could buy, we might get a better deal on a new right back. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to necessarily be a centre back. You know, we might get a better deal on a backup to Ayling,
new left back.
We've bought Cody Drama. He might be good. I have no idea, really. You know, he might be a really good backup right back. In which case, moving Ayling to the right of a back three would not be as much of a problem. That's hypothetical. I don't know how good he is, but it's just an idea.
We're getting in dangerous territory of just talking about transfer strategy again, but my issue is always that when your transfer strategy is high risk, then it serves you right when things go wrong and then you end up having problems. Whereas for me, the simple solution here is just get another centre back. It doesn't even need to be someone that glorious, and maybe they'll never play and maybe it won't matter. Like, this is why Berardi was great for us, because he did the job and that was it. He covered a few positions and he was just sort of there as the backup to the backup, and that's what we needed in this situation. That's what we need this season, though.
Don't get me wrong, I mean, I love the idea of Gvardiol from the bits I've seen of him. Like, he looks great and he will fulfil that role, I guess, of backup centre back, and I'd rather wait and get him than bring someone else in because things are dragging on. I don't mind if we get him in October, personally.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll be able to weather that storm. But I think these are well trodden discussions between us now, so I'm happy to move this one on now. Let's just talk a little bit about the players that we're expecting good performances from. I guess this is a more general question at this point in the season, to like, who do we think is going to perform well in the Premier League, Darren?
I think there are players who've definitely, you know, clearly got the quality to do that. Whether they'll get the minutes to do that is another matter. So for Saturday, I don't think we'll get 90 minutes out of either Pablo or out of Rodrigo, and I doubt we'll see Rodrigo at all. But I think both of those have got the ability to play very well. Ailing is always very consistent, and I don't necessarily see the jump in level being too high for him. I think he'll do well. I think Click will continue to perform in a very consistent way. I think Calvin will do very well in terms of his defensive duties and responsibilities in the system. I think he will have to learn some hard lessons in terms of how we go about the possession. But I still think he's capable of stepping up a level. My question marks are around the front three, I think, more than anything else. So I'd be interested to see how Bamford makes a step up. I'd be interested to see how Harrison makes a step up. I think I expect him to improve again. I know that probably John, you and I have a slight difference of opinion about that, but I do. I think Harrison improves every year, and I do think he will continue to do so.
Give him 30 years and he'll be a great player, I'll tell you.
Stanley Matthews.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think he'll benefit from the additional space that he will get in the Premier League is my view, really.
I think he's definitely going to be better in the Premier League in terms of, like, I think his upside is really as a pressing player, actually, and defensively, I think he's very good. And I think in a season like this, there's going to be certain games where he's going to be useful, and you know, there'll be games where he comes on for the first 50 minutes, and then we bring on a more decisive attacking player, I think, who will then be aiming to score the goal. So I'm okay. I enjoyed watching him against Passos this last weekend, because I thought he played tactically very good. And my issues with Harrison are always, I think, in terms of decision making and effectiveness around the goal. Look, at this point, when you're looking at scoring fewer goals than you did last season, it's not going to be as big a problem.
No,
Tom, have you got any insight into who you think's going to do well this season then?
It's difficult to say, isn't it? Because we're not a team with standout players, really. I mean, our standout player was probably Ben White last season, and he's not here. So I think first touch is going to come a lot more into it than it did last season. If you take a bad first touch in a Premier League, you're dead, basically. So that's why I think with Harrison, you know, that might help him. His first touch is excellent. Click has got a good touch. And it's about whether... It's really hard to say, isn't it? It's really hard to say about any of these players, because they are, apart from Costa, pretty much, you know, untried in recent times in this league. So I don't have any good answers. I don't have any insight. I don't have anything. I've got nothing.
Of course, the only players that we have who have had a season of good performances in the Premier League are Pablo Hernandez and Adam Forshaw.
Who's still at the dentist.
Still at the dentist, unfortunately. But let's just keep that one percolating away at the back of our minds. Right, one final question. How do we expect the game to unfold on Saturday, Tom?
I think it'll be a bit of a blitz in the first 10 minutes, whether that's Liverpool blitzing us or us unexpectedly blitzing them, which I think is less likely, but could still happen if we catch them unawares. And then it'll settle down into Liverpool having most of the ball, no matter what the score is, and us trying to press and counter. And I think it really boils down to whether we can keep our heads with that. And when we do get the ball, play our game and not panic at the back.
Mm. Darren?
Yeah, hard to say. I don't think Liverpool are the sort of team who regularly absolutely blow teams away. Although I am expecting Liverpool to win, I don't think it'll be a hammering. I don't think we'll go down as easily as Norwich did last year. I think it will be a game which is decided in the margins of Liverpool's elite players ultimately.
Well, there you have it, guys. The first preview podcast of the season is concluded. Just one quick thing to say is that I have already got my tactics thread ready. The other guys have checked through it, made sure my workings are correct. So I'll probably put this up at some point on Thursday morning / afternoon. So that will be the first tactics thread on Twitter of the season. So hopefully you'll look forward to that. If you like our content and you want to get more of our content, then we have a Patreon channel, which is basically a site designed for you guys to subscribe to us and get more in-depth content. So we put videos up there, we put bonus podcasts up there, we put guest posts up there as well. If that sounds interesting to you, head over to www.patreon.com/allstatsaren'twe and have a look at what's going on there. Three people who have done that very thing this week are Ashley Stewart, James Smethurst, and Daniel FM. So thank you for getting on board, guys. We'll be back next week on Monday with a Liverpool review in which we will be able to look back on all of the things we've just said and laugh heartily. But all that remains for me to do is to say thank you, Darren.
Thank you. I'm changing my prediction. Bielsa's going to pull off a miracle. We're winning 2-1.
And thank you, Tom.
Yeah, ta.
And we'll see you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.